from stpetecatalyst.com.
Hi, I'm Bill DeYoung. This is the Catalyst Sessions for Tuesday. Thanks for joining us. I'd like to introduce you to my friend Rui Farias, who is the Executive Director of the St. Petersburg Museum of History. Hello, sir.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. You got a big new parking lot there, I noticed, when I was down recently. That was part of the pier design, wasn't it? I mean, right on the side there, isn't that all new? The access, yeah.
Yes, I mean, a lot of it is, yes.
I just remember, I can't remember where I used to park when I would come down there, but now there's this huge thing on the side. What is being a part of the pier, the new pier, do for you down there?
Well, it's still a new experience for us, obviously. I remember when a few years back when the old pier was closed, I kind of did a state of the museum address in front of city council, and one of the city council members had asked us, you know, how bad it was now that the pier was closed. And actually our attendance shot up, because when they opened those parking lots as the overflow of Beach Drive parking lots, we were actually getting a lot more, foot traffic. But the last 2.5 years, behind the pier construction fence has been kind of tough. But since the pier has opened, I mean, the walk up traffic has been great. We're, you know, our attendance numbers are shooting back up to, you know, where we projected them to be. So, and just the awareness, building the awareness. A lot of people are walking in and looking around going, I didn't know you were here. So it's been a huge help for us.
That's kind of what I, you know, assumed, to tell you the truth, that this would open up a new avenue of people who hadn't had the experience of going into the museum yet. It seems much more open now, you know, like it was, like I said before, it was kind of, especially behind all the fences and stuff. Where is it? Have you noticed a difference in traffic since the pier is opened?
Well, yes, and mostly because obviously there's a lot more foot traffic, but also, you know, as you talked about the parking, the parking lot is now adjacent to the building. So when people pull in and park on the north parking lot, the Pelican lot, it is, you know, literally right next to our building. So it is building a lot of awareness for us. And we've done some stuff as well. I mean, you know, we've given the building a lot of loving, the existing structure. I mean, we've painted it, we've remodeled it, we've added some signage to it. We're doing some fun things to it in the next, you know, few months with some of the things we'll be adding to the exterior. So it's got a huge, you know, we've been here for nearly 100 years, and this building's been here since the 50s. So it received a huge facelift.
That's, you know, let me start there, Rui, because that was actually going to be my first question, and we just started talking, but give me a little history of the History Museum. You know, obviously it wasn't the same building, but has it always been in that location? Give me the whole backstory.
Sure. We actually started the Historical Society started in 1920, so it's 100 years old. But the museum itself, there used to be a building that sat on the same spot where we are now that was an aquarium. A gentleman had a business that had, you know, obviously displaying fish. It was a tourist attraction. And the storm, October hurricane of 1921, flooded it, as it did most of downtown, destroying a lot of the wooden piers that were downtown.
This is pre-million-dollar pier.
Oh, yes. This is back when it was the first true municipal pier, but it was a wooden structure.
Yeah.
Which was damaged in that storm. And then after the storm, we had a matriarch by the name of Mary Wheeler Eaton that kind of, her and her friends kind of led the charge of creating the Historical Society. And if you look at some of our photos we have in our archives of everything from the Benoit Plain to the steamships that were here, there's photos of Mary Wheeler in everything. So it's obvious that she ran this town. Convinced the city council and the mayor to turn the building down in the early 50s. The new structure was built. And then we've added on since then. But yeah, we've been here for nearly 100 years.
I know you can tell me this, but I can't remember how old St. Petersburg as a city is, but I'm thinking that in the 20s, there wasn't that much history to talk about yet.
No, and we were incorporated twice in 1903, the most recent time, but they collected a lot of stuff. Our collections, numbers in the tens of thousands of items. And you know, there's a story that the, you know, the director of the museum or the curator would show up in the morning to unlock the door, and there'd be boxes of stuff sitting on the doorsteps that people would just leave for the historical museum. And, you know, and understandably so, you know, when St. Petersburg, as it grew and a lot of retirees moved here, after they passed, a lot of their artifacts that they brought from up north ended up in our collections along the way. So, and it's crazy, some of the stuff that we have that we're discovering actually now that's been tucked away for 50, 60 years, because we're in the process of recataloging everything. And man, some of the things that we're finding are truly bizarre, and we're actually putting on display as we find them.
Well, give me some examples. You know, I'm thinking, it's like, oh, Eli Whitney's cotton gin is up there. We've got 100 of them.
Close. I mean, why in the heck do we have President Taft's pajamas? But we do. And they're on display right now. He was a big man, and there we have them framed
on the
wall.
The big jammies.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. General Custer's reading glasses. I mean, we're discovering all kinds of things like that. Pieces of the USS Constitution, the original USS Constitution. Geronimo's autograph. I mean, it's just bizarre the things that we're discovering. Land grants from early Florida, when it was still West and East Florida before it was a state. And we're discovering a lot of cool, unique things like that, that, you know, as we get them, preserve them, we stick them on display as quickly as we can.
Well, how, devil's advocate though, Custer's glasses, I was going to say Custer's sunglasses, but probably not, has nothing to do with Florida or the history of Florida. I mean, can't you sort of barter with some other museum to get something cool that would apply to you? I don't know how this works.
But you know what though? And that's a question that does come up. Like, what is President Taft's pajamas have to do with Florida?
That's a very good question.
I think it tells the uniqueness of our city. I mean, St. Petersburg, you know, we started off with like 12, you know, and we were a fishing village and an agricultural area. And I mean, the uniqueness of the city, this is just, it's a bizarre city, really cool, unique history. And people from everywhere just came here over the years, either to visit or to move. And a lot of the things that we've collected, I think, represent some of that uniqueness. I mean, we have a 3,000-year-old Egyptian mummy.
Yeah.
You know, and but it ended up in St. Petersburg in such a cool story that we have to keep it because it makes complete sense.
Tell me that story. I remember that story, but let's go there. Why well, is that mummy here?
Okay, I'll give you the brief story behind it. So basically a ship was traveling carrying a carnival and came into the port of St. Petersburg and needed repairs. When the repairs were finished, the captain didn't have enough money to pay for the repairs, so he gave the mummy and a sarcophagus to the dockmaster in exchange for payment. So the dockmaster was charging people, you know, a nickel, a quarter, what it was to go look at the mummy.
Wow.
Once the bill was paid off, they donated it to the museum. So it's been here since they're, you know, 26, I think, 25, 26. So yeah, the mummy's been here for almost 100 years. So
has it been, you know, what do they call carbon dated or whatever?
That was the question actually, because, you know, it was part of traveling carnival. So how they know it was real? So they ran it through, and they couldn't run it through a regular CAT scan machine. They had to run it through the one that's used for dolphins for marine life. And it truly is a 3,000-year-old Egyptian mummy.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, again, I mean, why is that in St. Petersburg, in a museum in St. Pete? But, you know, it begs the question that we've been dealing with is, what's our role going to be? Are we a St. Petersburg history museum? Or are we a history museum in St. Petersburg? Right. And we've got lots of stories to share. I mean, not just of St. Pete, but of Pinellas County and Tampa Bay and the state of Florida. And this is all the cool stuff that came here over the years. So
where did the calf come from? The two-headed calf?
Safety Harbor.
Oh, well, of course. Man, you got to explain that now.
It was born in a ranch in Safety Harbor.
It was, oh, okay.
Yeah, and then when it was, and of course, after it passed, it visited a taxidermist, and now it's been on display here for, again, since, I think, 1926.
Wow.
And you'd be surprised, because, like, when we were doing some remodeling to that gallery, we moved the two-headed calf, and it was in my office, actually, while the work was being done, and people were coming into the museum, and it was like a parade of people coming into my office, because I was getting calls from the front desk going, you know, this woman's here and she wants to show her grandkids the two-headed calf. You know, she remembers it when she was a kid. So, you know, it was just people walking in and out of my office looking at
this. You brought them in. Yeah.
So
what, percentage wise, the material that you have on display, both, you know, permanent and temporary, I guess, what's the percentage of things that you have that aren't out? You know, you usually hear that from art museums. Well, we've only got 10% of it on display. The rest of it's all in storage. Is it like the same way with you?
Pretty much. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know the exact percentage, but
yeah,
what we have out on the floor is kind of a fraction of what really we have in our collections. we have, you know, our collections area upstairs and in our archives area upstairs in the museum, but we also have two offsite storage facilities.
Wow. That's got to be what a daunting prospect to go out and, you know, this month is to dig through that warehouse. Yeah.
But, you know, that's been the case, though. And it's, you know, God bless the people that, you know, that ran this museum for a number of years. A lot of it was volunteer based.
Yeah.
And in some of our earlier collections, the notebooks are either typewritten or written by hand. You know, so our collections manager now is going through everything, like I said, and recataloging, photographing, putting it in the database and doing it properly. And this is how we're discovering a lot of these things. Like we have an exhibit on display now called Building the Sunshine City, which shows the growth of the city from
the
1800s to current day. And she discovered, when she was going through a lot of the documents, she discovered two documents that we have in a case on display now. One is an newspaper article from the Seabreeze, which was the first newspaper here on the Pinellas Peninsula. And it details the story of a gentleman moving here or buying land from Detroit, Michigan by the name of John Williams, that he bought Paul's Landing and other land, which is now downtown St. Petersburg. Yeah. And also there's a document that basically gives part of that land to the Orange Belt Railway. So in those two documents lay the birth of St. Petersburg. And, you know, we've had them, you know, for forever, and they haven't been on display forever. So, you know, it's been a fun time finding that stuff and bringing it out for people to see.
Does that give you chills when you see something that you haven't seen before that's got a direct link to something? I think as a journalist, that happens to me sometimes. I'll find something and go.
All the time.
Holy shit.
All the time. I get, you know, every time my phone rings and I see the extension upstairs and, you know, it's my collections manager going, you need to come up here. So I know, like, for instance, I mean, she found documents that were commission papers signed by Abraham Lincoln. And I'm looking at these documents in a folder going, this is really Abraham Lincoln's autograph on these, you know, on these papers. So we're finding some really cool stuff. But to answer your question, oh yeah, serious chills when we find those things.
I tell you, you know, I don't think I understand people who just don't give a hoot about history. To me, it's just, it's so cool. And especially, you're a St. Petersburg native, am I correct?
Pretty much. I was actually born in Connecticut, but I don't remember Connecticut. I've lived
there. Okay, so you and I were St. Pete kids. We're not exactly the same age, but we're in the ballpark. Tell me about the St. Pete of your youth. And obviously I'm getting around to Webb City here, which we're going to get to. I'm going around circuitous. Right. Tell me about what was St. Pete like when you were growing up?
Oh man. I was fortunate enough to live downtown, and it was just an amazing place to grow up. And I still teach a Florida history course at St. Pete High. And I try telling my students what, you know, life was like and St. Pete in the late 60s, early 70s, and the things that we used to do and see and enjoy. And, you know, my first job was selling the Evening Independent on the steps of the open air post office, you know, and it was, you just don't see that stuff anymore. Then I would deliver the Evening Independent on a bicycle, you know, after school in the afternoon. It was a much different city. And I look back now and I either bike ride or, you know, streets that I don't typically drive every day. And I'm looking at a lot of these buildings that have been quickly disappearing, thinking, man, I wish I would have taken more photos of this stuff back in the 70s and 80s, that, you know, these beautiful 1920s homes that were still there at that time. But it was a much different city, much more laid back. And it's weird, though, because, like, people – so one of my early – jobs in my professional career is I worked for the Festival of States. And I worked with the Sun Coasters putting on the Festival of States for 7 years. And this was during the bad time of downtown. This was during when, you know, if you wanted to take someone to lunch, you had to drive to Harvey's because it was the closest restaurant to go to. But I remember that our whole focus was to create events to bring people downtown.
Yeah.
Because nobody came downtown.
Right. I remember those.
And it's funny now you talk to people, you know, who grew up here and they're like, oh my God, I hate going downtown because there's no parking. And like, this is what we worked for, you know, 20 years.
That's a really good point. I tried to explain to people.
Make up your mind.
Tumbleweeds and crickets, you know. And
yeah, exactly.
Nobody went downtown. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the festival, let's remind people what the Festival of States was, because you probably, at least a couple of people who are watching this are going, what's he talking about?
We're all America welcome springtime. I still remember all the taglines. I love that. 2 week long civic celebration. So it was kind of, it was Gasparilla without the craziness. Art shows, three parades, and it actually started, to be honest with you, the Chamber of Commerce looked at starting something like this a million years ago. They're trying to figure out how to keep the tourists here one more week. Mm-hmm. Made some changes to it because when tourists would come here back in the day, at the Chamber, they would register with their state associations. With your state association, once a week they'd have lunch or breakfast or get together and talk about what was happening back in Michigan, kind of thing. So the Chamber, then later the Sun Coasters, convinced these state associations to start building floats depicting their state, thus the Festival of States. So they'd had these parades with all these floats in it, and the next thing you start inviting high school bands from those states, and
yeah,
the whole thing grew. So I mean, at the height of it, I remember one year, and it's always hard to judge outdoor attendance figures. It depends on who you're talking to, obviously. But I remember one of the main parade was called the Parade of States, and we had, according to police estimates, were 250 to 300,000 people downtown. So it was a big deal.
I marched in one of those with my Cub Scout troop when I was about 10 or something. You know, I remember it was really hot.
Oh, yes.
Like today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So Monday I had a Vintage St. Pete piece about Web City, which you were kind enough to talk with me at length when I was working on that. Just for those of you who don't know, Web City was, I can say it's a store, but at its height, it was 77 stores over 10 city blocks. And if you know what I'm talking about, if you were here, then, oh my God, you remember Web City. But you remember Web City very well, and the story of Doc Webb is something that's, you know, kind of close to your heart. And tell me why. You know, is it inextricably tied up with your childhood, or just because he was so cool?
Both. Yes, it was definitely tied up my childhood. I mean, growing up downtown, we lived four blocks from Web City. So it was a big part of my childhood. I know a lot of my family members worked there growing up. But it was, you know, people claim it was like the first, he was way ahead of his time. It was like the first mall. It was way more than that. If you took, you know, shopping in a carnival type atmosphere and entertainment and just craziness and threw it all together, you had Web City, and plus the crazy promotions that he did. And he was a master marketeer. I mean, the guy came up with ideas that were way ahead of his time.
Tell us some of the things that he sold there that you remember very specifically. You were telling me about, you know, canned Florida sunshine.
I still have a can, actually, that I showed to my students.
Better not open it.
Yeah, no. So basically, it's a can, like, you know, size of a can of peas or something. But, you know, it's labeled, you know, genuine Florida sunshine. Yeah. And, of course, it has this marketing thing on it that, you know, not to open it, you know, north of the Mason-Dixon line, because, you know, Yankees will, like, lose their minds because they're not used to this bright Florida sunshine. But, I mean, you know, it was an empty can, and he sold hundreds of thousands of those things.
Pre-pack rock.
Yeah, there were things like anything. Well, I remember when you walked in the area where the grocery store was, when you actually walked into the main building, on the left, there was a men's clothing store, but then there was, of course, was the barber shop. And that was the thing when you were a kid, when you were a young man, you wanted to get your haircut there because you walked across the hall with your receipt and got a free double dip ice cream cone. Wow. So yeah, you'd be begging your parents every Saturday. I need a haircut. You know, it's like, I need a haircut. I mean, and he would just do some crazy things. He would bring the circus to town. He would just put the circus tents up, you know, in the parking lot. He would do, I remember he shipped in or trucked in on train, actually, ice or snow rather. Cause you know, most of the kids growing up in St. Pete had never seen snow. He brought
trains like that. Snow,
yeah. And just wow. dumped it in the parking lot and it'd last like an hour or two, whatever, you know, but the kids would like have snowball fights. He did that. I think we talked about like the watermelon season. I remember back then, I mean, you ate fruit towards, you know, whatever the season was.
Whatever the season was.
Yeah. And I remember, gosh, when the watermelon train car loads of watermelons were coming, it was just like a huge party out there, you know. And then, of course, you know, I don't think we were around when like the heyday was marketing stuff, like the rooftop events that he would do.
The roof garden. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, he brings folks like Tyrone Garden. I mean, Tyrone Powers to the gardens.
Yeah.
You know, I think the Andrew sisters actually performed there once, if I'm not mistaken. You know, and of course he, you know, he would do crazy things. Like he claimed that, he would be the first person to sell $1 million worth of war bonds during World War II. Mm-hmm. And he did. So he, you know, brought in all this entertainment and they had nonstop stuff going on stages and he sold $1 million worth of war bonds in a relatively short period of time. It was less than a week, I think, actually.
He was also he was a really good businessman. I mean, for all the, you know, wacky low prices and everything, I read somewhere that, you know, he always paid cash. He bought in bulk, which kept his overhead right. down. But he was, you were telling me, in the early days, he would take IOUs, like in the days of the Depression, when it was right. Webb's Cut Rate Drugs.
Right. I mean, when you think about it, he opens the store in 1926.
Yeah.
You know, right at the time when the land boom collapsed in the state of Florida. And, yeah. you know, in less than 4 years later was the start of, the, you know, the Great Depression. And even during the Great Depression, his stores continued to expand and Webb City grew, actually. And made profits during that time period. And he was extremely concerned with building a loyal customer base.
Well, what I'm saying is he wasn't just sort of a snake oil salesman. You know, he was good to his customers and he was good to this city.
He was both.
Yeah. Okay.
He was definitely a snake oil salesman, but he was good to his customers. And he, during the Depression, he would take IOUs, he would take chickens, he would take whatever for payment for products that people needed.
I wonder if he took, mummies and two-headed cows as payment, you know.
He probably would have. Yeah, I'm sure he would have figured out somewhere how to make money off of them, yeah, along the way. And granted, you know, he was a good businessman, but he fought for what he thought was best for his customers.
And someone told me that he did not have an office, that he literally just roamed the store with a bullhorn. Someone else said that he would like, we got, you know, chickens, 3 for $1 or something, you know.
He would. And there was, his office was, it was almost like an open veranda, like on the second floor. So he could literally walk around and look down into the first floor, like where the grocery store was and the other stuff. Wow. So, you know, and he would definitely... He would see things that weren't selling. And it was almost like in a lot of stores, like for instance, you know, the Kmart Blue Light Special, they stole that from Doc Webb. Mm-hmm. Or they took their version of it from Doc
Adapted
Webb.
Adapted it.
He would see, you know, you can go buy cans of peas for a nickel or whatever, you know, type of thing. So when he saw things weren't moving, he would do stuff like that. But he was also, you know, like I said, he was business smart because people would, they think, how could he do this? All of a sudden he'd get a truckload of lettuce or melons or chickens or whatever. And the train would pull up right next to Web City and load all this stuff. So if, let's say he was selling lettuce for like a nickel a head back then, he knew he was going to do that. So he would raise the price of maybe tomatoes and cucumbers like a nickel or a penny each. So he'd make up some of that money, right, along the way. But it was just part of the whole, you know, promotion.
Web City, I think it was 54 years it was there, but ultimately, you know, the Times caught up with it. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean the St. Petersburg Times or the Independent, although they did catch up to it quite a bit. But the interesting thing about him, you know, the Pinellas Park store opened and kind of failed. But he was already, he'd already bailed by then. It seems like he saw the writing on the wall and said, and his wife had passed. And correct. I think he was getting ill, but he sold all his, he sold his interest in it long, like 5 years, I think, before it finally went bankrupt.
Foreclosed. And he, I think that, the one, I mean, as successful and crazy successful as he was in, you know, in business in the city, the one thing that he didn't realize was the next generational shopper. And I still remember this. I remember this like it was yesterday. So Sears in Roebuck used to be downtown on what was then 9th Street on MLK, where the County Health Building is across the street from Coney Island. Yeah. So that was the Sears store. I remember when they moved to where they were at Tyrone Square Mall, but the mall wasn't there. It was just the Sears store.
I remember. I was going to Tyrone Junior High School at that time, so I remember very well.
There you go. Yeah. So I remember my father used to love shopping, you know, tools. Of course, you had to go to Sears to buy tools.
Oh, yeah.
So I remember being there, my dad and him looking out, and they just cleared the land, and they were putting up like the steel beams, you know, to build the mall. And my dad looking out the window saying, this is going to be the end of downtown. And pretty much it was. Yeah. And Doc Webb didn't, it was too little too late, I think. I think he thought that his loyal shoppers would continue through generational situations. But, you know, people like shiny new things. And, you know, when the city after World War II and the city started moving further west, shopping centers were being built, and finally the mall in 1972, I think it was, that, you know, opened up. It was too little too late, and he didn't do enough to compete with that along the way. But he was smart enough, business enough to sell his stock. Yeah. And that's what he did before he actually sold it to the Texas-based company.
There's still a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth about, oh, you know, it's just too bad that the old stuff is gone, or, you know, passed. To me, it's like, I think change is inevitable. I think everything has its time. And, right. And you know, witness St. Pete. The St. Pete of today is very, very different from the one you and I grew up in.
Correct.
I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I'm grateful there isn't a Burger King on every corner. You know, give it time. Maybe after you and I are gone, there will be. I don't know. Hey, listen, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to talk with you about the expansion of the museum, which has been talked about for a while. Kind of what's happening and you know, timeline for that. What you think is going to happen?
Well, we had three stages of construction. We completed the first one and the third one. The second stage was supposed to be the expansion, a 10,000 square foot expansion to the museum, that will include a visitor center, as well as the second floor would be our new permanent exhibit space where we would move all our collections to an exhibit to keep them safe, you know, from the elements. And then on top of that is a rooftop terrace that will overlook the entire Pier District in the downtown.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's going to be gorgeous. We were supposed to break ground this month, the pier delay happened, and then, of course, the COVID situation happened, and it pushed us back. So we kind of changed gears, and everything that was in phase three, which was going to happen after the expansion, which was going to give the existing building a lot of loving that it needed, we did that while we were closed. We closed on March 14th and just recently reopened. So while we were closed, we did all that to the existing building. So now we're moving forward again with the expansion process, and we're hoping to break ground after the first of the year, which actually works out perfect because that means we'll be done and open to celebrate our 100th birthday.
What year exactly is that? Your 100th birthday would be
2022. Will be 100. The museum itself will be 100 years old. Yes.
the Historical Society. What was that lady's name who's in all the pictures?
Mary Wheeler Eaton.
Okay, I'm going to remember that. Yeah. You know, there. One thing I've talked to Will Michaels about is there. You know, they're going to put up the Janus statue. Sometime maybe September, October, something like that.
That's what it looks like. Yes.
Are you guys tied in with that at all? Because of the, are you doing anything for that?
Yeah, we've been working with them on it. I mean, it's a great project. It's, you know, on the exact site where the hangar was, where Tony Janus pushed that thing into the water.
Like, yeah.
And we have the working replica still hanging from our ceiling.
I know.
and that whole, the Janus Benoit story is a huge part of our new main exhibit that we'll be building, because it was an amazing piece of history that the city owns. So we're looking forward to it. Yeah. It's going to be great.
We had Mark Ayling on here, and actually it's been maybe 2 months now, but he was, you know, working on it, and he took the camera or his laptop, you know, through his studio, and he was formulating Janus and the mayor's heads, you know, and here's how it works. So I'm looking forward to writing about that too. Rui, I think we are done today. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I'm going to call you later. Something else I need to ask you about for yet another piece of St. Pete history.
Anytime. But you know what? You mentioned, like, if the city didn't change, we wouldn't have a history museum. So
yeah, boy, you know what? I mean, in another 100 years, you're going to need a few more floors.
I know. Right? No kidding.
My friend, thank you.
Thank you.
Take
care. You too.
All right. From stpcatalyst.com.